EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
That is French for the button. I learned that in American Vacation, or no, National Lampoon's Vacation, European Vacation. Yeah.
No. Congratulations.
You have homework, you have to see this movie. All right, folks. Yeah, it's been a while. Sorry. We've had adult lifing things to be doing.
Yeah, it turns out we don't get paid for this.
Yeah, so this one kind of took a back burner to EMS duties and other life events, but here we are, another episode. And if you're not sure what you're listening to, this is, again, EMS on the Mountain and other stuff.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Today, we're going to talk about, I guess, I don't know when this is coming out, next week, probably.
Yeah. We just went to Fast 25, so we thought we'd talk about it.
Yes, so Mike and I attended Fast 25, which is a conference put on the good folks at FlightBridge Ed. This is our second year in a row going, and it was very good this year. This year, I would say, speaker-wise, was significantly better than last year. Well, I won't say significantly better, but definitely better than last year.
I'll throw the bomb.
So, absolute heavy hitters in the industry, giving speeches and talks, trying to educate us poor fools sitting in the audience. Several of them getting deep on some things, making you feel like absolutely nothing. With that, Mike, what are your initial thoughts on this year's conference?
All right, here they come. They're coming.
Fast and furious.
First and foremost, this is the second year in a row I've attended Fast 25, or the Fast Conference. So I've been to 24, I've been to 25. I'm probably going to go to 26. One of the cool aspects about the Fast Conference, and this could be a bias because I haven't been to a ton of other conferences, but the ratio of no bullshit good speakers to time spent at the conference is pretty high. We had Jeff Jarvis. We had Dr. Antevi. We had...
Who was it? Dr. Peel, Will Huser.
Will Huser. Like,
yeah.
Of proverbial ballers in the space in 2 days. It was pretty cool to hear what they had to say. Both years in a row, you and I have attended the pre-conference portion as well.
Yep.
On whole, I would say that the pre-conference events are worth attending for sure. It's a little bit of the same stuff in the, we've attended the Cadaver Lab both years, but that's okay. Right? Like, maintenance of skills is important. The ability to get in and do multiple iterations of intubation on a real cadaver is something that most providers are not exposed to on a regular basis, right? Unless you work for a really well-supplied flight system that's doing cadaver intubations on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Like, as a 911 medic, you're not going to get a lot of exposure to cadaver labs unless you seek them out. And so out. And that's, I consider that valuable. It's useful.
No, and that's one of the good things. And I think with the cadaver lab, you and I were never scared to get, especially for the airway stations, right? Get in there and do the things. Like, some guys get bored, whatever. It's, and I'll go again. And they were really heavy on doing soiled airway and using salad stuff this year.
Yeah.
Which last year was pretty much just, let's just intubate, right? And so this year where they were all about doing, working some salad stuff, which was awesome on the cadaver. And on just training heads, like just normal rubber, better high fidelity heads for as far as salad training and everything goes.
Yes.
But doing those is fantastic, right? Seeing different things, using different laryngoscopes.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of us use the Mac in our day jobs with EMS. So using a Mac, getting on that, and then trying a couple of the different video laryngoscopes that are out there, doing a little DL. is phenomenal, especially, yeah, like you said, when you can get actually on a human body, because it's definitely different than any, pretty much any rubber head out there, even the really good high fidelity ones. And I've used some in training, really good, like some of those high end thousands of dollar airway training mannequins, and the cadaver will beat those hands down every time for obvious reasons.
But I mean, it's a real human, right?
Yeah. And then obviously getting hands on crikes, needle, surgical, fingal thoracostomy. Anytime you get a chance to do those on an actual cadaver, not just some rubber training mannequin, holy cow. On the first one, when we're getting in there and the guy does first incision demonstrating fingal thoracostomy, he's like, get in there, feel the diaphragm. Mm. I want you, like, and a few people are like a little sketched about shoving a finger deep inside this cold cadaver body. And I was like, yeah, let's get in there. It's like, oh, and I was surprised at how it was not the, it didn't feel the way I thought a diaphragm would feel. But basically the goal behind that was, if you're ever doing one of these and you think you've gone too low and you feel this, you're above the diaphragm. So at least you didn't screw that up. But if you could touch the diaphragm, you definitely went too low.
You definitely went too low. That's for sure.
But feeling that diaphragm and the explanation of, hey, this is what it feels like. And if you can feel that, you're at least in the chest cavity. Mm-hmm. And really that one was more to do with inserting chest tubes, vice finger thor, same principle applies. And then there's the, what else was it? Oh, some a bleeding control station.
The control station, yeah.
Or they actually wire up a cadaver to bleed for you, so you can actually have to pack a wound to see if you can get control of it and apply tourniquets and things like that. Overall.
Yeah, overall, it's been quite great.
Yeah, so it's, I always feel better leaving that, especially than when I go for my next intubation. I know I've done what we'll call a live-ish intubation. Like, I've just seen this on a human. Like, I'm good. Like, I've just seen airways pumped full of crap. I know I can work through this, so let's go with it.
Let's roll. So you and I both left a little early in order to make our 8+ hour drive home not completely painful. But in general, all the presentations were great.
100%. We only missed the last two.
Two, correct. It was pretty awesome to have Dr. Antevi explaining how recommendations are formulated and how the AHA like guidelines work. Basically, he's nudging everybody to think about what you're doing and understand where the rules come from.
And I think what was good about him was, I think a big part of his speech with it, he said it without really trying to say it, is know when you can, we'll say, break these rules.
Yeah.
Because some of these guidelines that have been put out by bodies like the AHA, and AHA is everybody's target. So if there's any AHA employees out there listening, sorry, but not sorry.
It's, yeah.
You bring this on yourselves. Like the use of epinephrine, it's kind of like, you know better. Why are you still doing this? This is a rule you should probably start ignoring, or these guidelines that have been established and other procedural type things. Like, why are you waiting until you get to this point before you do something aggressive, get the airway or do that finger thoracostomy, things like that. And I think that was, and not to, he didn't just blindly said it, but like he threw up the research and the data behind why you need to be thinking about these things and some starter points to start having conversations with your medical directors and whoever manages your EMS programs. Like, hey, doc, I know this is just a one-time conference and a one-time speech I just got, but he brought up some really good points, showed some literature, and what was good about Dr. Antevi is he made all of it available. You scan his QR code and you can download everything he just gave you. So you can take it back and say, hey, we should really start looking at this. This is a change in some stuff. We should probably be looking at this because I think it applies to us. And I think that was, for his part, really good. And for those who don't know, which I'd be shocked if you didn't, but Dr. Peter Antevi, he's the founder of the Handtevi system based for pediatrics, right? So he's a pediatric emergency medicine specialist and like absolute luminary in that field. And he is hugely passionate about EMS. And he's one of those guys that is strongly advocating for more robust independent practice for paramedics.
And yeah.
So when you listen to him speak and bring up why we need to start moving ahead with some of these legacy guidelines and policies, that it's, I think people need to really listen.
I agree. It's always great to hear Dr. Antevi push for doing what's right and not doing what's in the rules. His system is a strong advocate of pre-hospital blood use and doing the right thing. And in addition to him, go ahead.
What I was going to say is, for those who haven't heard this, I keep forgetting what they call this. It's not flash frozen plasma, but it's this new plasma preserving. I want to call it air fryer plasma, but that's not right. But either way,
it's,
I don't, I forget. It'll come to us eventually.
Yeah.
But the bottom line with this one, there's this new methodology for preserving plasma to make it much more stable and pre-hospital field use friendly. And I'll guarantee you that when that stuff becomes available, gets its FDA approvals, his agency is going to be one of the first in the nation to start implementing its use. Like, he will be right out there at the front of that, pushing everybody else to get off your ass and start doing this. And basically, the stuff he's talking about with using it, outside of those cases where actual fluid hydration is necessary, they fully anticipate this will essentially replace all of your crystalloids as far as not just trauma, but for other sick patients, right, that don't need a liter of normal saline or lactated Ringers. This is going to become the thing to start giving
TBIs,
people.
Sepsis, like, oh, yeah, anybody that needs the components in the blood for clotting, like, all of this seems to make a lot than saline, right?
Yeah, so that's, and if we figure out what this stuff, the new technology is, because it's not just flash frozen plasma like everybody talks about FFP. It's a different technique. And I guess it actually allows them to pump this stuff out like quick. Like, they can produce shitloads of it, but it is what it is. But the bottom line, he's bringing up the future of EMS, not like lagging behind kind of thing.
Yeah, he's definitely a freeze-dried plasma. No, that's not it. It'll come
anyways.
To me. It's not.
If we don't remember it during this episode, we will post it on our smeeges.
We'll put it on the socials. The smeeges. Look at you. Does that stand for social medias?
I can put it on the line.
I'll put it on the lines. All right.
That's right. Put it on the line.
One of the things I found absolutely shocking is Rich Levitan is the gold standard in airway management, right? That guy is like, he's the OG of do it right, do it, don't screw this up.
Don't be a bitch, do this.
But the whole time I'm listening to him talk, and if you haven't heard a Rich Levitan lecture on airway management, hit the tubes of you, because it's worth it.
He knows a thing or two.
He does. But for his entire first portion, he was just talking about logic, right? Like, it wasn't even the mechanisms and the how do you intubate somebody and how do you do it right and solid techniques and this blade over that blade or all that noise. It was, hey, man, you ever seen a human being that's having trouble breathing so they lay down to breathe better?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, just I've always been an advocate of sitting people up because it just made sense. They tend to breathe gooder. But just the logic of your organs aren't pushing on your diaphragm, gravity's helping pull things down. If there's fluid in the chest cavity, like getting gravity to pull it to the bottom of the chest cavity makes a whole lot of sense. But the fact that in EMS today, we're still, put them on the cot, lay them down. That's how we treat people. Those days have to die. They have to die right now. Everyone should be sitting up. There is no need for anybody to lay supine, period. Unless you're doing something procedurally. And he even said it, right? He's the reason we lay people down is to make it easier for the surgeons.
Yeah.
Last time I checked, we were not doing field surgery. So there's no need to lay people down.
And I can't remember if it was his speech or one of the others, but somebody else hit it as well. Like, laying flat is the position you're buried in. So think about that one. Nobody should be laid. And everybody's like, but what about backboards? Backboards are the devil's device. And
they are.
We should be using them absolutely minimally. And B, it is possible. I know you can't ramp them very high, but you can elevate people on a backboard. You can at least get them up at a 10-degree angle, at least get it helping you a little bit. And that's all we're going to say about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, the whole lay them flat. I didn't even know the last time I had somebody who was even remotely flat, and it's because they were on a backboard and I didn't have much of a choice. Mm-hmm. But they were popped up a little bit. As much as you can realistically safely do in the back of an ambulance. But that's it. Like, those are the only people that I've backboarded two people in the last 6 years. Everybody else has been able to be on the cot and put in a position of comfort, which is generally in some sort of Fowler's, semi-Fowler's seated position. So, you never showed up to anybody's house at 2 a.m. for trouble breathing and they find them laying flat on the floor.
No, they just sit perched
they're
forward,
sitting
right?
on the edge of those couches.
That was a general takeaway for all of the presentations, really. We can talk about all this newfangled science and we discovered these new drugs or whatever the case may be, which doesn't actually happen as much as you would think it does. But at the end of the day, we're just talking about people. And we're still not very good in pre-hospital care about caring about the basics. Not caring isn't the right term. we're not getting the basics down right. Like, just sit people that are having trouble breathing up. Like, if Meemaw's uncomfortable in that position, move her to a more comfortable position.
Right.
There was some reference to traction splints I found interesting. I couldn't find a lot of data on it, but one of the presenters said something about traction splints are actually starting to show that they cause more harm than good. Like,
yeah,
just splint it and move on.
Yeah, which is, I know you and I've had shared that practice for years now is, because, and for folks who are curious, so a lot of times, like if you had enough of a mechanism to break a femur, there's a chance you've injured something in your hip or pelvic structure. And most traction splints require you to anchor at the hip or at the pelvic ring, basically to make that traction work. And so you can start elongating and pushing on things that you don't want to elongate and push on.
Right.
And then just the additional strain on like ankle joints, knees, et cetera, when you're briefing all that extra tension on the leg. Yeah, they're finding that traction splints are not the ideal solution to a broken femur. And I've been aware of this for a long time. It's not like this is new knowledge that's come out. It's just getting more and more popular is not quite the right word, but more and more people are becoming aware of it and it's finding its way out. So, you know, just and like there was mentioned, like just use a traditional, like long, basically a board splint. Take one of those orange padded boards you've got in your ambulance that you never break out because most people have SAM splints for your minor arms and lower ankle fractures. Break that thing out, stabilize that femur traditionally, and you're off to the races, go to the hospital. And I think one of the most interesting things, just because you always hear about it, it's partly because it's an education thing, always training to the worst case scenario, is that the amount of blood loss associated with femur fracture, even a significant femur fracture, is not as great automatically for everybody as we once thought it was. We thought everybody that's got a solid mid-shaft femur fracture is dropping a liter or two, and that's actually not the case. And it really only happens when you have significant mechanism like bad trauma and that thing's shattered and arteries are getting nicked and things. So,
yeah,
that's all I got to say about that.
Who's the guy from Ireland? Van der Veld or something like that.
Yeah, that dude's talk on peds was amazeballs.
It was. But a key takeaway for me, which he mentioned multiple times, and it was clearly a nudge toward the American system. Every unit in Ireland is, their bags and everything are set up the same way with the same equipment, the same spot, using the same stuff. Mm. It was a really interesting parallel, I guess I'll call it. You know, we always talk about checking your equipment and making sure you know where your stuff is, et cetera, et cetera. That's EMS 101. If you're starting your shift and you're not checking your bags, you're probably failing. But the fact that he was really advocating that he can work out of any bag that is brought to him for the purpose because he knows it's going to be set up the same way because they have a uniform standard. And I know agencies try to do that sometimes, but oftentimes when you're working in a wilderness environment with multiple separate agencies, you don't get that luxury. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is like, even if you look at where we do our wilderness backcountry work, you and I used to have standardized bags until a mouse ate mine and I had to switch back to another one.
Right.
Because, you know, that way you and I both knew exactly in our bags where each other's stuff was because they were the same.
Yeah.
But outside of us, every other responder that showed up has a different backpack. I don't think anybody up there's got the exact same med bag.
No.
And even if they did, nobody's going to organize it all the same. So we tried to standardize it. One of the program directors tried to standardize at least their individual BLS bags years ago, and that lasted all of about, what do you think, 3 months? And then all those providers like, I don't like it like this, and they all started switching back to their legacy style. And so that went right back out the window. But I think it's great that Ireland, which it's great when you can have a national, basically EMS pre-hospital program like Ireland, England, etc. Problem is you can do that in the U.S. by state. Just Europe is incredibly small compared to the U.S. Ireland's the size of, I don't know, Idaho. It's probably bigger, but I'm just throwing out a rough idea. So you could take a state. We're just in FASTO. You could take Kentucky and I think Kentucky might actually have statewide protocols. So some places have statewide protocols, but they don't have a statewide, this is what a BLS bag, this is what an ALS bag looks like. All the individual agencies do that. And what I think is probably the bigger takeaway from his talk that I really appreciated was, regardless, know what's in your bag, know exactly where it's at, what state it's in, and know your fucking medicine and your procedures.
Yeah.
Right? So that when it comes time to do that surgical crike, my crike kit is in this pocket. This is what's in my crike kit. I know it's all there because I looked at it today, and this is how I do it, and I know how to do that procedure. Whereas if you haven't seen the crike kit in 3 months, is it even in the bag? And then when you need to have it and you can't find it because maybe it got used and never replaced,
yep,
that would have been good to know 20 minutes ago, right? So I think that's probably the universal takeaway is know your job, A, like whatever your scope is, EMT, wilderness first aider through paramedic, know what your scope is, know how to do all of those things that you're supposed to be able to do for your agency, know your kit and make sure it's all there and present and where it should be. That's for us in our wilderness environment, that's about as best as we can hope for. We're not going to get people showing up with bags that all look just like ours just because we've been there longer than all the rest of them. It doesn't matter. So anyway.
Yeah, the big thing for me in that was he talked about the cognitive offloading, right? It's all the time. You don't have to worry about finding anything. You don't have to spend the time going, I'm looking for a thing. And any of us that have done this a while know that if you're looking for, how we've got pictures, I think we might have posted them at one point of like bags I've yard sailed looking for a thing. And then after I yard sailed the bags, I was like, oh, there's the thing I'm looking for, because I couldn't cognitively understand that the thing I was looking for was staring me in the face because I was worried about the next 8 things I had to get done for this dude that ate a minivan. So sometimes it just reduces the cognitive load. Not sometimes, it does reduce the cognitive load because you go to this pocket with this vacuum sealed pouch and it's got these things in it and you've trained that so much that you don't have to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
What else did you take away?
I think not just him, and this was surprising, it didn't really come from Dr. Antevi either, but the reminder that peds are indeed small humans. It's like, don't vapor lock because it's, oh, and that was actually Dr. Vanderveld too, right? Because all his were about 5 pediatric studies. It was like,
yep,
don't vapor lock because it's a kid. Treating a kid is the exact same as treating an adult. Yes, it's weight-based. There are apps for that, right? You don't have to do that math in your head. Like, I know I can go to my agency's protocol and you look at this, and then up at the top of that page, I can hit for the pediatrics and it'll tell me exactly what the dosing needs to be based on whatever that med is. Like, there's ways to do that, as you said, cognitive offload, as far as I don't have to memorize that I give this medication at 0.001348% milligrams microdecimals per kilogram of a child on Thursdays. I don't need to know that. It's good if you have that memorized. By all means, I'm not telling you not to. But what I'm saying is there are plenty of tools out there where you don't have to, if you forget, and you don't have to try and second guess yourself and do that math in your head. Use the tools you've got. And there are books, like if you want hard to, what if my phone fails? The technology is going to fail you. That's fine. There are pocket books for that. Or you can carry small laminated pocket cards that have your standard pediatric doses on stuff. Just, there's ways to do that. But I think the big one is, yeah, like for the young kids, right? The 2 and underish crowd, I would say probably. Yes, there are those anatomic differences, bigger heads, smaller airways, floppy, soft airways. Got it. But outside of that, treating anaphylaxis is treating anaphylaxis, right? An airway problem is an airway problem. And understanding that, yes, they have a smaller, more narrow, softer airway and foreign body is a bigger concern for them than adults. Absolutely. But you know that. Now fix it. The trauma, right? Like pedestrian struck, whether it's a 6-year-old or a 60-year-old. Right? Stop the major bleeding, get the airway going. These aren't new concepts. And basically it was like, don't be scared just because it's a kid. Know your medicine, know how you treat the things, and then just treat it. And I think that's really important because everybody still, I won't say panics, but if you ask a provider, like, what's the only call you don't want to deal with? It's, I got peds, right? I'd rather do just about anything else than deal with a ped. And it's not that I want pediatrics, mostly because I don't want kids to get hurt or be super sick that I have to show up and do work. But that shouldn't be a call that's like scaring you to death. Oh my God, I don't know if I could do this. Like, treated, right? Same way you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. All right, kid not breathing. Okay, let's make breathe. Step one, how's the airway?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's make airway's breathe. Open.
Paramedic. Yeah.
Yeah. Make child breathe. Like, exactly. Okay, let's get some oxygen. Do we need to do a little non-invasive? Give him a couple of breaths, see if that kickstarts some things. Yes, no, okay. Do we have to progress all the way to intubation, right? Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same problem. It's just on a smaller sized human, right? So just fuck people. Deal with it. And all you pediatric nurses that listen, if we have any of those, you can scorn me forever for saying that kids are just little humans. But ask yourself, if you had a 6-year-old and a 66-year-old with the exact same ailment, what are you doing different besides dosing?
A whole lot. Just saying.
Anyway, that's one of my big takeaways with him too, and that was probably the first time I ever heard Dr. Antevi speak, because again, he's a ped specialist, and that was his thing, was stop being afraid of kids. They're just little people. Like,
you're not going to break them.
Yeah, it's like,
in fact, he said that, right? They're pretty resilient.
Yeah, I think that came from several speakers. It's like, anybody who's just dealing with peds is like, they're very resilient. Just do your job. Like, it's cool. Yeah. So anyway, what do you got next?
Okay, can we just talk about how William, is it Hoser? Huser?
Yeah. Huser? Yeah. Heiser? Hoser?
Boy, does he make me feel dumb. Like, that man, holy cow.
Yeah. So
he's clearly passionate about what he cares about. And he's a pharmacologist, along with being a paramedic and a firefighter. He's a doctor now.
And a college professor for pharmacology.
He just knows stuff, man.
Yeah. And if you've ever heard him speak, seen him speak, and I thought I was a big fan of ketamine. This man.
He loves him.
Loves the ketamine. And that's, I think that was, he obviously, not obviously, that was his big speech, was he's talking about some updates in the world of pharmacology, and discussing ketamine was, of course, one of those, because that's a huge passion drug for him. He's a huge fan. And this was ketamine in refractory status epilepticus, right? So those patients that keep seizing, if you guys haven't heard, if you've gone through a couple of good doses of your benzos, more benzos doesn't fix it, as we've learned. And he went into the deep pharmacology and pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics I use paramedic school words,
right,
on why benzos quit working, basically. And to simplify it, you've taken and used all those receptors that the benzos work on, and you flooded it with so much shit that they no longer care. They don't function as they should anymore. So now you got to go to something else, because benzos are not going to work. And so ketamine is the new hotness when it comes to breaking those seizures. And I know you helped one of our providers out up in the hill who was having a status case. And you were like, here's what you need to do. And you laid it out and said, here, when you call for med control, tell them this is what you got and this is what you want. And it worked, right?
Ketamine stopped that seizure almost within 30 seconds of the drugs getting
used. And that's what's, and they're starting to look at it in asthma reactions as well, for people who are in status, to get things back under control when you've been doing all the things and it's still not going. Like, ketamine is now working its way into that too. So that I don't know as much about, but I'm finding it fascinating that ketamine really is this, I don't quite go wonder drug, but wonder drug that does a lot of stuff for us, especially pre-hospitally. When you can have that one vial that, man, pain, sedation, seizures, asthma exacerbations, like, holy crap, like, this thing really is a one-stop shop to help you with a lot of different things. But you got to understand what you should expect it to do, like we always talk about here. Know your shit. If you don't know your medicine, you don't know the drugs you carry and why they're doing what they're doing, or at least a general idea. I'm not going to know nearly as much as Will does. I'm not a doctor of pharmacology. I'm never going to get there, as much as I'd love to, and study and be deep on that.
Well, you're kind of like,
I could learn all about ketamine, but I would have to pretty much purge all my general pharmacology on everything else to get that good, right? This is a guy that just lives it all day, every day. This is just his jam. But know your drugs. What are you expecting them to do? Like, you've given that another round of benzos and you're like, shit, they're still seizing. Can I call for more benzos? No, you should probably be calling for ketamine at that point. Yeah. But you got to know what you're asking for. Because the doc's like, I know ketamine's a thing. Can I give it? And if they're not familiar with it and you just are expecting them to give you a dose and everything else, it's probably not going to happen. But that is what it is. But yeah. And of course, he did bring up the everybody's favorite topic when it comes to pharmacology, the use of epinephrine in cardiac arrest and why mm-hmm. that's probably a thing we should just stop doing. And he wasn't the only one. I think that was one of Dr. Jarvis's topics as well, because I know his department, if you listen to his podcast, the use of epinephrine out of hospital cardiac arrest is...
In any sort of shock or rhythm, it's nope, not at all.
Anyway, but
I think
if you're not familiar with...
heavy use agencies have gone to one epi as well. Like they've gone...
Yeah, I think a lot of places are stopping at three max doses.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm at, we're all in for five, which I would like to get rid of, but that's not up to me.
Not even that important, Sean.
No, I'm definitely not important.
No.
And we've had, I don't say it's even our agency, like we only carry five, right? So once we hit five, you have to find another ALS med bag to get more. And we've actually called for termination of efforts and had docs go, I want you to do two more rounds. Let's do it. Really? Seven rounds of epi? You really think number seven's going to hit it? Okay, my man. If it makes you feel better to make sure they're really dead, sure. But that makes everybody just on scene roll their eyes like, fuck, seriously? All right. This one will bring me my back. Thank God. Anyway, sorry. Rant.
And I'm back.
Are you, though?
I think my internet
just died. How's that
go? I'll edit that out. Anyway, I don't know what you're saying, but I'm just going to say this. Smart people, Bruce Hoffman. That man's lecture on acid-based balance and...
Love me some Bruce.
Holy cow. He's incredibly smart, and he knows things and stuffs. That was the first time I've heard an anion gap versus non-anion gap metabolic acidosis explained in a way that my dumb paramedic brain could process and be like, oh, there's the difference. And when he had lab values up there, and he's like, this is a standard metabolic acidosis of this sort of presentation. I was like, oh, it's all starting to click. Like he did a great job explaining it at a level that like the knuckle dragon 911 medic and me could get it.
100%. And I will say I've taken the flight bridge. What do they call it? Their FPC, CCPC prep course. I've taken that. I've seen other lectures on the anion gap and all that other stuff associated with it and been like, yeah, so that's some math and some lab values that I'm not going to generally have access to. Sounds cool, but...
Yep.
And then when he broke it down, it didn't just... Not just with the anion gap, non-anion gap kind of acidosis piece, mm-hmm. but just some of the acidosis stuff clicked into place again when he was talking about why certain things happen, which I thought was really good. Just filled in one more little piece of that puzzle that you're like, ah, okay, that makes more sense now. Okay, I get that now. And so he is phenomenal. He's a great educator too. I know we had him last year in the cadaver lab as well at one of the stations, and he's just a great educator, very personable. He is all about talking to people and helping them learn. Like he is he's just one of those really good dudes. Like I really like Bruce, and anything that he wants to teach on, you can pretty much be rest assured it's going to be a good lecture.
Yes, I agree. All right. This has been short and sweet, but there's also no need to belabor it. Basically the theme here is Fast 25 is definitely worth attending. You should go. Well, Fast 25 is over, but the Fast conference, Fast 26, you should definitely attend. If it's on your radar, consider it. If it's not on your radar, put it on your radar.
It'll be in Austin, Texas next year. So you Midwest and folks out there in the middle of the country. It is, like I said, Mike and I have only been twice, but both years have been really good.
Yeah. And the whole Flightbridge crew, and they're all personal able to help. Like everybody's awesome.
Yeah, and not that we're going to go schmoozing too many people. Like, most of them won't even remember Mike and I's names or who we are after we've left. They've got our money, right?
Yeah.
But, like, Eric and Ashley Bauer are super nice, super willing to talk to people. Their staff, Bruce, and all the other people, they have collected a really good group of people within Flightbridge. And we're not sponsored by Flightbridge. We don't get shit from them, right? We purchase their products just like the rest of you.
Yep.
But it's Mike and I both believe in the work and the stuff they do and what they put out. It's good. And For those of you who listen to us and are interested, they have partnered with CoRAM, the College of Remote and Offshore Medicine, and they are doing a full WPC prep and review course. Yeah. I haven't done it, but I have done plenty of CoRAM courses, and I've done plenty of FlightBridge courses, and I can tell you it's probably going to be a good course. If any of you take it, we'd love to hear from you. Shoot us a message, send us an email, and we'll bring you on the show to talk about what you thought of the course. Get the word out there.
Absolutely.
And I think the only thing I'm going to say in closing before we go is this did occur over what is known in the U.S. as EMS week. So that we get our week of cold pizza and free pens in the EMS room. Gee, thanks. Yeah, they try. I won't knock it. But the thing I'm going to take away from this is something we've been preaching for, well, long before we were doing this podcast and ever since we've been doing it. And that is, if you're not continually trying to train, learn more, increase your knowledge and your skill set, then you're stagnant and you're falling behind and you should probably leave, right? So going to things like FAST or any of these other good put together conferences where you're learning some good quality stuff, hitting those cadaver labs, like doing those skills. Like I haven't done a finger thoracostomy in about 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. It's been a hot minute since I've done one on an actual human that wasn't a cadaver. But I like to go and do these things at least once a year on a cadaver. So I can say I've done it. I actually cut human flesh. I've had to poke through the pleural space. I've gotten my finger inside there. I've felt around. I know what it feels like. I know what that anatomy is. And it makes me feel better knowing that I've done this, not just on some of those shitty rubber trainers that we all have to use because of cost is a thing. But
yeah,
that's my spiel for the end of this is whether you go to FAST, you go to big EMS conferences out west, overseas, in whatever countries you live in, go to them, learn, right? Train. If you're not getting better, increasing your base knowledge, then, you know, you're falling behind
because
EMS is continuing to evolve.
I will advocate that it is, even if it's not FAST conferences, it is critically important as a well-rounded practitioner to get out and hear the science and the perspective from people outside of your agency.
Like, absolutely.
It doesn't have to be a FAST conference or whatnot, but if you end up in the echo chamber of your agency, there's a lot of stuff on a day-to-day basis that is said because somebody else said it, or Bob in the agency was the guy that knew this. I had somebody recently, not going to throw any names out there, any shade, but I was doing a skills refresher with one of the agencies I'm affiliated with, and the individual said to me, during the crike, you want to make sure you cut the skin because, and then be ready because you need to have 4x4s because once you cut the cricothyroidic membrane, there's going to be a lot of blood. And I was like, no, there's not. It's not a, unless you do it wrong and you nick an artery or a vein that runs up the side of the neck. There shouldn't be a lot of blood when you cut through the cricothyroidic membrane. It's a membrane. It is not a vascular thing.
Yeah. And but, the skin is basically all capillary. There will be blood.
There's going to be blood, but not a lot.
Yeah, there's not going to be giant spurts of oozing blood. Like,
but he was really worried about managing all the blood. And I just, no fault on him, right? Not a lot of us do on a regular basis in the field. But it was something that somebody else said, that somebody else said, that somebody else said. And it is only through my attending conferences and being exposed to talks by people like Dr. Antebi, by Rich Levitan, and the folks on the edge of the science that you end up with people inside of your agency that are advocating for the right thing to do and change and progress. If not, you end up just stagnating and doing what, you know, what some would refer to as the old crusty doctors that have just always been doing it the same way for 50 years. They're just going to write you a protocol and that's the way it is. If we're going to see change, if we're going to see progress, if we're going to see improvements in patient care, especially in longstanding, more austere environments where you need to be given a certain level of autonomy and you need to understand what's going on. You need to maintain that knowledge. And the best way to do that is to not only do your agency's training, but attend external events that give you a different perspective and a different way to think about things and force you to understand the problem at a visceral level. So,
yeah.
All right. Should we call this one done?
Certainly.
All right.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, Thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.